All right, hello everyone. This is ARPA Canada. We're talking about the Barry Neufeld decision. I'm here with John Sycamore, our legal counsel. I'm Colin Postma. Obviously, this is something that received quite a bit of attention over the last week or two, and that was that Barry Neufeld, who is a, I believe he was a school trustee and a variety of other things in the Lower Mainland in British Columbia, received a fine of $750,000 from the Human Rights Tribunal there. So obviously the number is massive, but who's Barry and why is this an important case?
Yeah, as you just mentioned, he was a school trustee for quite some time. I think first for a stint in the 90s, then a break, and then I guess was asked to come back. He actually, back in the 90s, had endorsements from teachers unions and others, their support to be a trustee. He's got a background, he has actually got a degree in adolescent psychology. He worked as a corrections and probations officer, actually working with sex offenders. Mm-hmm. And that background will kind of become relevant in this case, since he sees sexual orientation and gender identity education, or parts of it, as in a way exposing children potentially to abuse, right? Questioning their identity, their sense of self. But anyway, so that's
he was working alongside the cops, essentially, in helping them to identify sex trafficking cases in relation to children in particular, or?
No, so he would work with people who had been convicted,
okay,
right, of offenses. So once they were on probation, he would basically have to work with them, check in with them, talk right with them. He spent a lot of time with sex offenders.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So continue what you were saying then in terms of what was going on.
Yeah. So he served on the school board. It's interesting to hear him tell it, just that, and even working with, he has a background too in working with troubled youth and young offenders, but that for him, this gender ideology, gender identity becoming later in his life, he's now in his late 70s, right, all of a sudden kind of coming on the scene when he was a trustee in 2016, and SOGI education being introduced as well kind of took him by surprise. But as he learned about it, he started to speak out about it already in 2017. And pretty quickly, the Chilliwack Teachers Association filed a human rights complaint against him in early 2018, which is kind of striking. You know, this is not a particular individual who's been disadvantaged in the workplace or fired for some reason. It's a teachers union basically taking him to the Human Rights Tribunal for his criticism of a policy adopted by then the Ministry of Education, right, and being integrated into the school boards. And from there, I mean, this is 2018, a lot of the statements that he made are just kind of added into the complaint. So the complaint would be amended to say, Andy said this discriminatory thing, Andy said this discriminatory thing, all the way up until 2022. And now finally we get this ruling based on events that started, you know, in 2017. We finally got this ruling in February of 2026.
Wow. So the human rights tribunals in British Columbia, obviously that's maybe paint the picture for that. What do they do? And they're different from the court system, right? They're not, this isn't a civil or criminal trial. This is something different. How does that work in British Columbia in particular?
That's right. The tribunal is created by the BC Human Rights Code and enforces that code. That's it. And on a complaints basis, right? So the Human Rights Code, in all provinces have human rights codes. They regulate employment, housing, services, even membership in professional associations or unions. The idea being you can't discriminate in those areas based on, you know, race, religion, sex, and other grounds. More recently, gender identity has been added there. So that's their job. Now, what differs between provinces is whether there is a provision in the Human Rights Code about discriminatory speech or hate speech. And BC has that kind of a provision. Ontario and other provinces do not, right? So, and this is where I guess we'll kind of get into on what basis does the tribunal find him to be liable. But those provisions, those kind of hate speech, discriminatory speech provisions in BC's law are pretty key there.
What do you think of the $750,000? Like, that's obviously the thing that's got headlines. Is that normal for cases like this? Is maybe BC an outlier in terms of, or are they just like the tribunal's just trying to throw the book at this guy and make him pay kind of thing? Like what do you have any idea what the thinking was behind this?
Yeah. It's not normal. I mean, again, normally complaints are brought by specific people who can actually say, here's how I was affected by discriminatory treatment or discriminatory statements. Here, it's, again, the teachers union. And the teachers union basically brings it as a kind of a class action, right? They're basically saying all our LGBT members are affected by what you're saying because it affects the school environment, their work environment, right? And so there's, you know, roughly, we think, they actually have an estimate that 16%, based on some studies, 16% of teachers identify as LGBTQ compared to 4.4% of the general population, according to Statistics Canada. So that's quite striking. Okay. But they basically pick a number, you know, X thousand dollars would be appropriate per member. There's lots of LGBTQ members. We're basically going to assume, based on a few representative witnesses, that all of them were impacted by this. And so you need to pay money to all of them. So it basically becomes a class action award. Right. Everyone gets he's not going to be able to pay this, but everyone in theory, is awarded
a few $1,000.
That's right. Okay. That's right. But I mean, the number is crazy, obviously. I think it's, to my knowledge, it's a record, a human rights award. And Mr. Neufeld has called it, in a way, a blessing in disguise, in that it does attract this press. And I think gets more journalists, commentators, even politicians looking at the ruling and saying, you know, what's going on here? And what exactly was he penalized so severely for?
Yeah, for that's huge amount of a fine. Like, there has to be some reason for it, right? And I'm sure that's what they're looking for, as opposed to a smaller amount, which maybe people would have just not batted an eye at, right? A smaller fine, they'd be like, yeah, well, this kind of stuff happens in Canada. That's just the way it is. But that's obviously not the case here. So
yeah, and 6 years ago, the BC Human Rights Tribunal issued an award for Morgan Ogier, an NDP candidate, transgender, you know, a man identifying as a woman, and Mr. Whatcott, who's been in plenty of legal cases, but he was distributing a flyer, right, saying this candidate is a woman, the media is lying to you. We've talked about this case before, and he had to pay $55,000. That was still a lot, but that case did not get the kind of press coverage. It really didn't. You didn't see conservative politicians like they are today commenting,
right?
And that's maybe partly a different story. Partly Mr. Whatcott being maybe somewhat more notorious, having kind of bad PR. But also, I think things have changed in the last 7 years. I think there is a bit more willingness among some political figures to be outspoken, to assert that, you know, well, there are two sexes or two genders, whichever term they choose to use. So that to me is encouraging, but in that light, right, you see bodies like the tribunal kind of clamping down. The tribunal actually starts kind of by saying the setting for this case is kind of the beginnings of progress. They're very much signal what side they're on. The beginnings of progress for transgender people with new policies, with SOGI 123, this is all progress. But on the other side, there's the kind of the number one opponent of progress, the kind of anti-revolutionary Mr. Neufeld. And that's kind of how they frame the case in the opening paragraphs, which is quite striking.
Okay. So what happens next? Like, obviously this is, we'll get into the details of exactly what he was charged with, but is there an appeal? Is there an option for him to take this somewhere else? Is this the end of the road? Like, what does that look like?
So no, it's not the end of the road. And in fact, for, you know, any of our listeners get into legal trouble with some bureaucratic body or other, there's always a right to apply for judicial review, right? So this decision is now final. Like I said, it was amended and kept going on for years, and they just added more and more things to their claim. But no, this decision is final from the tribunal, but he can, and my understanding is he's planning to, they're already working on appealing that to a court.
Okay. So then that will move into the judiciary stream and then proceed as it would normally from a regular court to an appeals court to all the way to the Supreme Court, effectively, if it goes all that way, right?
That's right. And a court is going to show, you know, some deference. They assume human rights tribunals have expertise in applying the human rights code. So there's, and even in, you know, they heard from witnesses at the tribunal. So there's going to be, it's not a new trial, right? But it's, so there's going to be some deference in terms of, well, the tribunal found this to be credible, that not to be credible, and so on. But the court's job is to say, did the tribunal reasonably interpret and apply the law, the scope of its own authority, the test for hate speech, and all those things? Even did the tribunal reasonably find that, you know, this so-called discriminatory speech really was that he was another interesting part of this case is that he was considered to discriminate in employment, right? So even in Ontario, where you don't have the hate speech provision, some of his speech, you know, it's easy to look at BC and say, well, get rid of your hate speech provision. We did that from the federal human rights law. But he was still considered to be discriminating in employment because he's a school board trustee, right? He's an elected official, elected in part for his views on you know, education policy, but he wasn't allowed to criticize SOGI 123. That was found to be employment discrimination simply by virtue of his being a trustee, right?
Making him the employer, effectively.
Right, but one trustee is not an employer, yeah. Right? That school board is the employer. Yeah. So sure, if the school board adopts a policy that's considered to violate the human rights code, that could be challenged. The human rights code is going to sit above any policy a school board can set. But that's not what's happening here, right? So the tribunal, this is a problem with tribunals generally. They're just expanding their powers by interpreting the scope of their own authority, yeah. By interpreting the human rights code.
And I guess that's the challenge with the tribunals in particular, is they seem to have more leeway for that kind of thing. Like a court obviously has strict boundaries in terms of precedence and what the law actually says. In this case, you know, a tribunal sort of given the leeway to interpret the tribune or the human rights code as they like to some degree, right? Is that kind of what's been going on there?
That's right. And the check on that, well, there's two checks, right? There's the judicial and the legislative, right? So yeah, the one check is the judiciary looks at it and says, okay, generally we defer to you, but clearly this is going too far. The legislature has not granted you this authority. But should a judge find, well, you do have this authority and this decision is reasonable, that's also not the end. I mean, obviously, there's more appeals you can do up until the Supreme Court of Canada, potentially. But there's also legislative fixes, which, you know, lots of commentators are now calling for, to say, hey, just like we removed the hate speech provision from the federal law, it's time to remove it from the provincial law. And by the way, one thing we didn't mention, one key part of this case was there's an interim decision where the tribunal asked the question, can we hold him liable for online statements, right? In certain ways, federal law applies to the internet. Provincial law doesn't in other ways, but they basically said, well, he's in the province. The statements were made in the province. The victims of the statements are in the province. So just the fact that it was online is not enough to kind of get him out of this. The tribunal can enforce the provincial human rights code for purely online statements.
Like Facebook posts and
that's right.
Blogs.
That's right.
Okay. So is this, would you say that he got into this trouble primarily because he's a public figure then? Like because he's a school trustee? And so they're going after him effectively for that reason? Or is this a situation where regular, you know, somebody, a BC resident posting on Facebook about the same issue, saying similar things, could fall into the same kind of trouble?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it is complaints based. So the fact that he is a prominent figure questioning an ideology and an agenda that the school board is and the teachers union especially is very much on board with, that explains, you know, the complaint in that way is predictable. But to your question, some of the things he said, certainly if anyone else in the province said them, they could be held liable. So there are certain things, this is the tricky part about the case, there's 30 different statements, Facebook statements, interviews with media, even things he said at the school board when debating these issues that were found to
be during their meetings.
Yeah, that's okay. Right. That were found to violate the human rights code.
Which is ironic because like you said, he was elected by people in the ridings and in the communities he was part of specifically to challenge this ideology, right? Like he was, to some degree, was running on that campaign almost, right?
Yeah, especially in his re-election. I think maybe not for the initial, it might not have been part of his campaign initially, but certainly he was re-elected
some
while this was all going on.
Yeah.
That's right. Yep. But of those 30 statements, some were considered to violate the human rights code because they had a sufficient connection to employment, to the schools, right? The tribunal actually finds 6 of his 30 statements did not violate the code. Okay. Partly because they weren't connected to public education, but again, that wasn't strictly necessary. They basically, the tribunal says the immediate harms aren't clear. So he has some comment about the World Health Organization and you know, can we trust them based on I think something about gender affirming care is maybe tossed in there, and they say that's not, you know, maybe not concrete enough. But in other statements where he's questioning gender affirming care and its consequences, that's considered hate speech. So when something, some of his statements are, we shouldn't be doing Soji 1-2-3, teachers shouldn't be doing this, school shouldn't be doing this. They say, well, that's discriminatory speech in part because of your position. And so the impacts of that are multiplied because of your position, and your position's significant. It's not kind of a strict rule, right? In fact, even if you follow some of the logic, you might say, well, a minister of education, or even an opposition education critic, or even a prominent public commentator, right? Could you follow the same logic and say, okay, you don't necessarily have to be a trustee. The employment piece, right? Discrimination in employment, he had to be a trustee. He was considered like close enough to being an employer, mm-hmm. or was sufficiently connected to employment. But again, with this Section 7 of the Human Rights Code, a lot of these things could be, especially the hate speech ones. There were 6 of the 30 that were considered hate speech, and that could be anyone in the province in any position, right? This was a public statement. We think it promotes hatred. You're liable for hate speech.
So let's get into the specific things. Like, maybe you have some examples of quotes that he was saying, whether on social media or maybe in one of these meetings. What is it? What exactly was he being charged? Like you mentioned, discrimination, hate speech, like the language of that. What is the specific wording in the Human Rights Code that he was found in violation of?
Yeah. So Section 7 of the Human Rights Code, and I just have it in front of me here. It says you may not publish or display or cause to be published a statement that, and then there's 2 parts. So first is indicates discrimination or an intent to discriminate against a person. Or group of persons as defined, you know, sex, gender identity, and so on. So that's first, indicates discrimination or an intent to discriminate. And B, is likely to expose a person or group of persons to hatred or contempt. So the first one is something like it is common in other human rights codes, the discrimination or intent to discriminate, but it's qualified more. So in Ontario's Human Rights Code, there is a provision that says, again, you're not allowed to have a discriminatory publication, but that has to be a publication that communicates an intent to discriminate in an area covered by the code, right? So that could be, you know, housing available only for this group or something like that. BC's is a bit more open-ended, just indicates discrimination or an intent to discriminate. Now, you should read that as, well, discriminate how? Discriminate surely contrary to law, to deny a service or to deny employment to someone because of some personal characteristic. That would be, you know, a reasonable reading of it, especially in light of the fact that we're a society with freedom of speech and so on.
And have some of these terms been defined in the BC Human Rights Code, or is that because I know in the court system, if I understand correctly, precedent and things like that help define some of these terms. But in this case, is there anything, or is it sort of just up to the interpretation of the tribunal what those words mean?
Yeah, and discriminate isn't a defined term in the legislation, but in a way it's defined, but just by its context, right? I mean, we discriminate all the time, and who our friends are, and all those. Yeah. There, clearly, this is, well, we're talking about unlawful discrimination. We're talking about discrimination of denying services, denying goods, employment, housing. That's the setting, but it's interpreted much more broadly than that. And even apart from that, there's part B, right? 7(1)(b) is likely to expose a person or group of persons to hatred. And that is, their hatred is a defined term in case law, right? That's the extreme emotion and so on. And that actually applies in criminal law and in human rights law. Okay. The same, that the standard proof is different. But that's where this case gets pretty interesting, because quite a few things that he says, 6 different statements, are considered hate speech, and that's quite a finding. And to give an example, he comments on a documentary that features a child who starts the gender transitioning process, right? And it's kind of presented as this journey of self-discovery and what have you. And Neufeld comments on it, I believe on Facebook, basically saying years down the road, you know, the truth may come out that someone ends up basically not able to form a family, and potentially, you know, homeless and depressed and so on. So, and the tribunal looks at that and basically says, this shows contempt for transgender people. It suggests that, you know, their lives are loveless and hopeless, and what's striking about the tribunal's analysis is they don't really do the formal, you know, hate speech law analysis. Now there's our hate speech law is wanting in many ways, but they don't say, okay, who's the victim group? How are you promoting hatred in others towards the group? I mean, clearly he's actually expressing in some of these statements concern for kids suffering from gender dysphoria and where they might end up when you start transitioning them. He's got another statement that says the elites, basically the elites are eliminating gay children, right, by putting them on this medical transition pathway. And again, the tribunal just looks at that and says, this is awful. I mean, you're appealing to these, what they call hallmarks of hatred. Like there's this big threat out there to children and that's going to rile up people's emotions. But again, if you stop and say, well, who is he accusing of doing this evil? In the statement, it's the elites, it's the government, right? Now, you might say, oh, that's connected to a LGBT agenda. There's places where he also uses that term, but there's supposed to be a specific group, right? Are you saying transgender people are targeting children for harm? That's not what the statement says, right? He's criticizing governments and policies and elites. And in that statement, he's actually, in his view, he's actually standing up for children he thinks might, you know, grow up to identify as gay or lesbian, and saying this transgender ideology teaches them that, hey, you might be born in the wrong body and so on, and starts them on a path that gives them another identity. So that's some of those comments. The tribunal just says, basically, it's almost a degree of offensiveness. The tribunal does a pretty shoddy job of actually applying what this strict test for hate speech is supposed to be, to just say, yeah, we find this to be likely to provoke an extreme emotional response and that it's designed to do so.
Why was this case running for so long? Was it partially because of some of those problems, like they were having difficulty actually pinning some of it on him, or it seemed to be, based on what you were saying, that it was stretched out over quite a period of time.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Any sense of why?
My understanding is they initially framed it as a employment discrimination claim. Maybe they thought, you know, that hate speech was a stretch. And I think it is. I think a court is likely to overturn at least some of the findings of hate speech. But they were probably also concerned that, you know, that question of is this employment discrimination? He is just a trustee. He's not the board. He's not the employer. As a single elected person stating his opinion, which, you know, elected officials should share their opinion on relevant matters with the public, that might not be enough. So they had amended it to add Section 7. And then I think the rest was just he continued to occupy the office. He continued to make those statements, and that the tribunal allowed the statements to be added to the claim because they were relevant to it, as opposed to having to start new claims for each subsequent statement. Right. So
effectively they were saying, we got to make an example of this guy and we just have to figure out how we're going to do it, as opposed to deciding whether or not he was actually guilty of something, let's say. So you mentioned the Section 7 being added. Did the provincial government get involved then at some point and change the Human Rights Code in response to this issue, or how did that happen?
No, so what I meant there was the Section 7 gets added as a basis to the claim. So he's first accused of, well, you're a trustee, you're discriminating against LGBT teachers because you're poisoning their work environment. Okay. By saying things on Facebook, or he's not saying these things in the school or in the classroom, but then they add Section 7 to their claim. But Section 7 has been in the BC Human Rights Code for a long time.
Okay, so the tribunal added that to the claims against him.
That's right.
Okay. So just on that point, though, so obviously the Human Rights Codes are provincial, meaning the responsibility of that falls with the legislature of the BC government. What could they do about this? If you know, obviously it's an NDP government, maybe they're not interested in doing anything about this. Maybe a future government, whatever. What could be done in terms of the Human Rights Code in this regard?
I think the simplest thing would be repeal Section 7, right? And that shouldn't be for the opposition conservatives, or the party 1BC obviously has this explicitly, I think maybe even stronger. They might want to get rid of human rights tribunals, which it's pretty well known. There's a lot of people with former, you know, kind of progressive activism. That's kind of who's selected to be in the human rights tribunals. People who have a demonstrated interest in social justice, normally lean left. But anyway, so, but the more modest thing to do would just be repeal Section 7. And you can point to, you know, there's a bunch of provinces that have no equivalent to Section 7. Right. So that shouldn't, that's not, that's a very moderate position. I've also been seeing calls for, you know, eliminating human rights tribunals, removing the human rights code. Politically, that seems, you know, less feasible. I don't actually even expect a major party to adopt that as a position, to say get rid of the code entirely and the tribunals entirely. But certainly removing Section 7 would go a long way. It wouldn't go the whole way, again, because for those who occupy positions of, you know, elected school board trustees, elected municipal councillors, we talked about the Township of Emo case where certain councillors voted against having a Pride Month proclamation, that they were also found to violate the Human Rights Code. So there's, and that was in Ontario. So there's other problems here that need addressing. Even in Ontario and other provinces, there are Human Rights Code reforms that are necessary to kind of rein in these tribunals. But in BC, the kind of obvious and immediate step would be repeal Section 7.
Yeah. Maybe I'm stepping into dangerous waters here, but is there any positive benefit to the Human Rights Code? Is there circumstances in which maybe free speech or religious freedoms are being protected by that potentially, or is that a remote benefit?
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion. If you take more of a libertarian stance to say, hey, you know what, if you decide, you know, let's say you run a hotel and you only want to rent to, you know, give rooms to certain people, well, so be it. Someone else is that's to your business disadvantage. Someone else is going to welcome all comers, and too bad. So that's kind of one position. I think, you know, I understand. I think there's a case to be made for certain basic protections to ensure, you know, that's kind of how it started, right? Really, even in the States, the Human Rights Codes first came really in the 60s and 70s to kind of say, okay, you might have formal equality in law, but then in society, people are denying you services, and that the effect of that is to effectively be in some ways second class citizens, second class members of your own society. So to say, no, we're not going to allow in certain areas, right? No one's saying you have to be equally open to being friends with or dating or forming some kind of a you know, social club with anyone and everyone, regardless of their identity. That's, you know, there is still freedom of association. People do discriminate, but to kind of ensure people get basic access to basic services and housing, that's kind of where this starts. And that, I think, is understandable. Again, you could argue the libertarian case that
is this that, the best way to do that?
Yeah, or yeah. Should just basically we just be free to be discriminatory, free to be prejudiced and to act on those prejudices, providing you're not kind of you know, directly hurting someone. That's an interesting debate. Where this gets, you know, where this gets very difficult today is with adding gender identity and gender expression to human rights legislation across the country. This was done really without debate, without kind of considering, well, what does that mean for sex-based rights and sex-specific spaces? Gender identity in a way kind of trumps and erases sex as a protected mm-hmm. ground. So it's caused a lot of confusion. And even gender identity, as we see in this case, is based on, it's kind of rooted in a belief system, right? An anthropology that people, I think, are right to challenge. And that actually is what is, you know, the $750,000 stands out and it's getting a lot of attention in this case. But really what's, I think, the most significant is where the tribunal gets into saying the term gender ideology, the term transgenderism, right, adding an ism to this, that in itself is discriminatory. That gives a kind of veneer of reasonableness to what is really just discrimination.
Okay, well.
Right? They basically say you have to accept a person's gender identity and even the concept of gender identity. To deny gender identity as a concept is to deny the existence of transgender persons.
And that's ironic. And it, you can hear echoes here of the CHP case that we were part of a couple of weeks ago, right? And in that, and we said at that time, it'd be interesting to see if there were women's rights groups there to speak for themselves, what they would have said in response to some of this, right? Because yeah, to say that gender identity is saying that or talking about the ism of it is to ignore the reality of transgender people. It automatically, in saying that, you're eliminating the reality of women effectively, right? Women and men. And for those who are trying to say, well, actually, no, there's a clear distinction in law. There's a clear, there's sex matters, really, right? In terms of protections for women and all these sorts of things, like, that's quite a shocking change in terms of across the board, just making that the reality in Canada, right? And that seems to be, at least with decisions like this, with decisions like the CHP case and others, that's becoming more common. Mm-hmm.
And the tribunal, interestingly, tries to draw an analogy by saying, you know, you can accept, accepting someone as a Christian, for example. So I'll read. So this is one of the most striking passages in the decision, where the court says, if a person elects not to believe, right? So this is a choice I guess you shouldn't make. But if a person elects not to believe that gender identity is separate from sex assigned at birth, then they do not believe in transgender people. Right? This is a form of existential denial. Gender identity is not, as Mr. Neufeld argues, akin to religious beliefs. A person does not need to believe in Christianity to accept that a person is Christian. But to accept that a person is transgender, one must accept that gender identity is different than sex assigned at birth. So they're basically saying, Christianity, you don't have to believe in Christianity to accept someone as a Christian. You do have to believe in gender identity and gender ideology to accept someone, to really accept someone as transgender. Otherwise, you're saying, you know, do I believe in transgender people? I believe a transgender person believes that they are male, you know, or perceives themselves to be male, or wishes to be male, or feels like a member of the opposite sex. But that's not really believing in transgender people. You're just basically saying their belief is wrong, maybe even delusional.
Sounds like the start of a, you know, progressive catechism has been, you know, that's the beginning drafts of it there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think, and that's what's strange is maybe not strange, but there's just this, you know, denial that there's anything ideological, anything even questionable about gender identity and their conception of it. Right. I think a better analogy, right, is, Hindus, for example, believe that they're essentially divine. Right, they're experiencing this life in human form, but they share one essence with the divine, and so I can recognize a person, right, as a Hindu. So I'm like, okay, you hold that belief while denying that belief. I can say that belief is false, right? But the tribunal says, right, again, to accept a person as transgender, you actually have to accept their belief. It'd be like saying to accept a person as Hindu, you have to accept their belief that they're divine, or to accept a person as a Christian, you have to accept their belief that they have a soul. Right. This is just mandating, if not mandating that you hold a belief, at least mandating that you never publicly dissent from or question that belief.
Yeah, it's quite a statement. So is that, do you think there's a chilling effect that this will have, or is your sense that, even just based on our conversation, that there is a more of a public pushback against this kind of statement, against these kinds of rulings, against, you know, common sense, I guess, in the public sphere. Just in terms of even our supporters, in terms of people watching this, is there reason for them to be concerned, or is this sort of another stop on the way to, okay, maybe some of these things will change in the near future?
Yeah, I think there's signs of both. So Lori Thronis, I believe he stepped down in solidarity with Neufeld, but maybe also out of concern that he could be next to have a human rights claim brought against him. On the other
hand, we're seeing BCMLA.
Yeah. On the other hand, we're seeing candidates and politicians actually say something about this issue now, maybe because they probably rightly think, you know, they're not likely to be the subject of a complaint based on, you know, making a tweet or two or a simple statement or two. So I think there is reason to be concerned. Others could be subject to complaints, but I think there's also, you know, there's that, I believe it's attributed to Edmund Burke, the quote that we like, that, you know, all that's necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. In this case, maybe to say nothing, right? I think the more people that do make public statements of some fairly basic truths about human sexuality, about the harmfulness of gender ideology, I actually think this is a good time to maybe capitalize on the tribunal's overreach, and the more people that are, you know, asserting and sharing the same message, right? And I think people should do so thoughtfully and carefully, and maybe even refer to Christian resources that state it well and clearly and thoroughly. But I think the more people who are doing that, if a complaint is brought against one of them and they can say, well, look, I'm actually sharing what lots of other people have shared, what this or that church has shared. That's a striking in this case that the tribunal doesn't do any analysis of freedom of religion, but what they're calling, you know, basically amounting to discriminatory speech is a position officially held by Reformed churches, the Catholic Church, Orthodox, like Christians. It's just they deny gender ideology. They deny gender identity as the tribunal conceives of it. And so the tribunal is basically condemning a wide swath of the population, and I'm sure others even outside of Christianity. That's something that's quite striking. But I think if people aren't standing up and saying, actually, we believe this too, then that makes cases like this easier to bring.
Yeah, and in some cases, the process itself is the punishment, right? It's not even what the outcome is necessarily. It's the fact that you have to go through the process of being involved in the Human Rights Tribunal, blah, blah, blah. But I think to your point, you're right that this is an opportunity for us to, as just regular Canadians, as regular individuals, supporters, to share that same message and push back against the changing landscape in that sense. So I'm optimistic that Mr. Neufeldt will not have to pay at least $750,000. But thanks for your time.
Thank you.
For the conversation.